Welcome to the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin, your source for real estate investment jewels of wisdom.
Welcome to the REI Diamond Show. I'm your host, Dan Breslin, and this is episode 136 with Ian Walsh on why your offers are not getting accepted. Ian is a returning guest of the show and a hard money lender from Philadelphia, also a friend of mine. Philadelphia is where I cut my teeth as an investor and grew up. Of course, I live in Chicago now. But today's discussion with Ian focuses on how you can get more offers accepted, whether you're buying from real estate agents, wholesalers, or even directly from sellers. This will all apply. So whether you are fixing and flipping houses, buying and then renting houses, or wholesaling houses, or even a real estate agent representing either side of either of those deals, you're in the right place and you're about to invest your valuable time, the next half hour or so, listening to a discussion that will help you make money by getting more deals done. Let's get right to it, shall we? All right. Welcome back to the REI Diamond Show. Ian, how you doing today?
Good, Dan. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, appreciate you making the time to share with our listeners here. I think this is going to be a pretty good episode for people who are flipping houses and maybe also people who are building residential real estate investor portfolios. And I'm going to kind of shortcut a piece of who you are, Ian. And although, Ian, like a caveat, if you will, for anyone listening, you're in the right place if you're interested in flipping houses, interested in flipping more houses, interested in figuring out how to maybe level up with the use of leverage. Specifically, today's topic is going to be using hard money. And I'm just going to set the frame, Ian, of market conditions currently. It's July, it's middle of July in 2019. And from my view as a wholesaler, and I'm sure a lot of people who are doing a lot of business on either the, you know, the buy side or the sell side of, say, wholesale transactions are probably experiencing a situation where cash is king. And it's difficult, if not impossible, to get hard money offers accepted with a lot of wholesalers who are comparing that hard money offer to a cash offer, which would, you know, usually come with less headaches, less strings, and less of a risk of falling out than the hard money offers. At least that's how it is for my company at Diamond Equity. And so we're going to address that during the course of this episode, as well as some other topics, but I kind of wanted to set the frame. Why don't you go ahead and kind of give an introduction, if you will, Ian, about what your business is today. And before you do that, Ian's a Philadelphia guy, but our topics and, you know, Philadelphia, DC, he'll mention where he actually does lend. But if you're outside of Ian's, you know, radius and network there, this is still a valuable episode that I encourage you to stay engaged with. So, Ian, you want to kind of paint a picture of what the business looks like today?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, exactly today, it's interesting you mentioned that. They just dropped mortgage rates, which is crazy. I don't understand how that's possible in this climate, but they did it. So we're in a lending world right now, a private lending world. I do I'm a traditional lender in the Eastern PA, New Jersey, Delaware, Maryland, DC markets. That's where I lend. But, you know, you can go to any market and find a guy like me. Usually just one. There's usually only one or two like me. And then there's a bunch that are typically institutionally backed. So I am your actual traditional hard money lender, where I'm really actually looking at the asset as my primary focus on the deal I'm looking at, as opposed to your credit or W-2s or anything like that. So right now, due to the climate of the market space of the lending rates being very low, you've had banks creep into this space. And basically what they do is in your marketplace, they'll put their, you know, a hard money name on in front of the, you know, basically on the billboard and say, we're a hard money company. But then you're already, you know, you're going to be sending your W-2s and tax returns in and going, hey, am I working with a hard money lender or am I working with an institutional, you know, bank? And the truth is, traditional lenders like myself, we are not there. There's not very many of us because it's very hard to have the funds to be able to lend out at the capacity that we lend out at without using a bank. So we chose a much more difficult route to do that. So I'll be speaking today from a traditional, you know, true and true hard money lending perspective, as opposed to, you know, one that you might bump into with institutional funding.
Yeah, and a couple of big differences to point out too there, Ian. First of all, you and I have known each other since probably 2007. So I've known you as a real estate guy, watched you progress in the career, and I know that you are, you know, an expert at viewing the deals, analyzing the deals, pulling comps to make the decision, and you know the construction costs. So you're not, you know, the institutional lenders with the W-2s and the appraisals, and there's a lot of systems and checks and balances, and you probably never get to talk to the person underwriting the deal. For me, that's a huge headache. That's why I typically, you know, I have a lot of people who lend money to my deals who listen to the podcast. That's why I, you know, pay out the interest rates I do, and I pay points on the deals to the people who lend to me. They trust in my underwriting the same way that, you know, you're trusting in your own underwriting to put the cash into the deal. And it's a lot less headache. I mean, I don't personally have time. We have like 100 plus deals on the board right now. I don't have time to do appraisals on every single one of them. You know, managing access for the appraisal, managing access, putting construction contractor bids together before the approvals come. So, yeah, there's probably some lower cost money maybe in some of the institutional lenders' world. But it comes with a lot of strings, and oftentimes the strings were the cost of underwriting, the legal fees. It ends up being more expensive, even though like the interest rate comparable to the hard money lender, like maybe yourself or like my private investors, the interest rate may be lower in the sevens or the eights, but all of the aggravation, the time, and then the fees end up making it more expensive. But we'll leave that, I guess, for a little later on then, Ian. So I wanted to bring up a problem. I guess I kind of framed it out a little bit on the front end. So obviously I buy a lot of houses myself. I honestly, you know, if I'm looking at a deal that I'm going to wholesale to somebody, if they brought hard money, you know, in the offer up front, I would probably take a lower offer from a cash investor because I don't want the risk of somebody, you know, a lot of times it's like a newer investor, somebody without a lot of experience. Basically, I don't want the deal to fall apart, and I've had a lot of hard money deals fall apart. Do you have any suggestions or insights for the buyer in that situation on how to get someone like my attention? If I'm the wholesaler and I've got the deal, like what would you suggest to your buyer if you knew that that was going to be the situation that the offer they were trying to get accepted with, like Diamond Equity's deal?
Right. So I'm very familiar with that scenario. Honestly, a lot of it is having a presence in your marketplace. So sometimes when I have somebody running up against that or somebody, you know, that they're saying, hey, I want to submit, but I want to submit cash or hard money because you're, I mean, I get it. I used to wholesale a ton of properties as well. And like, you see that hard money come through and you're going, I don't know, who's this company? And then, you know, is it going to be based on appraisal? Is it going to be, you know, all these other steps where there's, if you just take a cash offer and you're done with it today, you know, I get that. So really what it's come down to from my perspective or what I've learned in is A, having a local presence. So like if I was trying to do a loan in California, you know, and they saw this hard money thing come over, that's pretty shaky. So being in your local market, so if you're doing a deal in Philadelphia or doing a deal in Chicago and you have a lender in Chicago who's a private lender located there or within, you know, a few hours radius, that means somebody is in that market. I also highly advocate for the buyer. I tell the borrowers when I'll send over a letter of intent to them that they can send over an approval letter. And I say, put me on the line with the wholesaler, you know, or put me on the line with the agent that, you know, is moving the deal. So I'll talk to them directly and I'll let them know. And, you know, I don't require an appraisal. You want to look for that. You know, if you're a true hard money lender and you're a wholesaler, you're going to go, okay, do they need an appraisal? Well, if they need an appraisal, that means they're really institutionally backed. If they don't need an appraisal, that means they might, you know, they're local money, meaning that they're going to have more, the person actually issuing the letter is going to have a lot more say or will be making the decision on that money. So if they've already committed to that person, it's not committed pending. It's committed. So you want to look for, is an appraisal required? How fast can they close is the other question. So I can fund tomorrow if title's available. So that's the other thing. People say I need 30 days or I need 3 weeks. now. Like you, a true hard money lender could wire the money in tomorrow, pending title being available, which all your deals will have title insurance. So that those are some key issues. I'd say timing. How fast could you actually move on this? Get on the phone with the lender. You know, you have you know, to get a comfort level with you, Dan. So if you were, you know, to call me, obviously you know me, but if it was, you didn't know me, you would call the actual lender and talk the talk. Most good wholesalers are going to know, you know, you start throwing around some of the jargon and understanding, you know, how this wholesale deal has to move. If the person on the other end of the line, it goes, I don't know how that works, or I'm not comfortable with that. That's a lot of inexperience. So you want to be dealing with a lender that has a lot of experience, because they're going to speak the same language that you speak, and they're either going to be comfortable with it or not. But, you know, local presence is huge. No appraisals and closing in 24 hours. Those are things you want to hear from the wholesaler's perspective. I think that's really important. If you can't pull that off, I get it. I get why you would take a lower offer. It makes sense.
Yeah, and I should point out right now that, like, ironically, I have never had a single one of the offers that we've closed on all the deals in Philly ever come with you backing the deal. They've never gotten themselves organized and, you know, brought it to the table. I can tell you right now, Ian, because of our history and because I know who you are and how quick you close, I would consider, if you said, yep, this is a deal that's good to go, I would pull the trigger on that one in a heartbeat, because I know you and for all those same reasons that you just mentioned. I think it's important too, right? So if you're listening in on a call and you're flipping houses and maybe you're used to dealing with some wholesalers, but you've had the cash, or maybe you're used to dealing with real estate agents, or maybe you haven't done a ton of deals yet, it's really important to understand the reason that these wholesalers come up with these, like, pretty cheap and profitable deals. And that reason is that that deal depends on speed. Like a seller, normally, wholesale deals that are junk and are never going to close is totally separate topic. But wholesale deals that are, you know, solid deals from reputable wholesalers that are profitable flips, like, those sellers sign that contract because they expected a quick as-is settlement with, like, not a lot of BS attached to it. So they didn't go get a real estate agent because they didn't want 30 days or 60 days of going through appraisals and going through applications, and then the lender comes and pulls the plug at the last point. And so, like, those hard money lenders, those hard money offers that I generally just delete the email when we get them to come in, like, that's what I'm smelling. I'm smelling that, like, institutional needs underwriting kind of scenario unfolding on the back end. So first things first, understand the deadline. A wholesaler is offering that deal, has that deal on the table for you because that deal depends on speed. So we can't have any hangups of closing. And Ian, that's not a problem from what you're saying, right?
No, with me specifically, no, never. I mean, I can't. I rely on, my reputation is extremely important to me. And if I tell you that I'm going to, like you said, you know, you would trust me to whatever deal you have. Well, you know, equally, it's just as important if you're a reputable lender in your area to perform. So you can't, if a lender commits to a 24-hour closing, the money better show up, because, or if they value the reputation. So, yeah, no, if I commit on a deal, I've always tell people, I say, if I am going to do a deal and I tell you I'll do it, I've never backed out on a deal. Fortunately, also knock on wood, I've never had fraud. So that would probably be the only way that I'd say, hey, I'm not doing this deal. You told me there was a house here and it doesn't exist. You know, that's not going to work out. But pending that happening, I will always close. Yeah. And, you know, the money has to be that. So one of the things with a 24-hour closing that it's really important to ask that is not just that it's impressive to be able to do that. It's what it's showing is the liquidity and control that that particular person you're talking to has over money at that moment, as opposed to a lot of times with an underwriting process, you know, a bank will have to allocate funds and wait for weeks for it to come in or what have you. So you want to know basically the only thing separating your deal closing and this lender is, like, and their bank account is this lender. Like, literally that bank account, that lender has a bank account with, say, you know, several million dollars, 10, 20, whatever the number is, right there. So it's one check signing or one authorization and it's done. There's nothing else to it. So that's really what you're trying to remove. I mean, I always look at it like when you're on the internet, right? And if you have to click through a bunch of ads or a bunch of yeses, nos, yes, nos, put in your email address, put in this, click here now. By the time you get to, like, the fourth step, you're out of there. You don't even want to deal with it. It's a pain in the ass. It might not work. You want to be one click and done. That's what you want. And that's the user experience that a good hard money lender will provide as well. So So that is really important from our perspective to be able to deliver that.
So do you or someone on your team physically walk through each property that you lend on prior to giving the green light?
So in the event of a 24, so we have inspectors that'll just go and they'll get pictures and do a quick evaluation to make sure the house is there. Like as I was, I'm most concerned with somebody trying to pull fraud. So they really go do a couple pictures and send it back to make sure. Yeah. You know, I'm expecting every time a house to be in terrible condition. I'm never expecting a house to come back in great shape. So that's fine. Like I don't really even much care what the pictures look like because I've already expected everything to be renovated. So it's really going to verify that the property is there and as stated. It's not, you know, other than that. So we have inspectors that'll go out and take a look. But, you know, we certainly had times in 24-hour closings where, you know, they had to come in after closing the inspection. I mean, I might know the area. I have a very good indication of what the property looks like. So, you know, they didn't have to have that into us before closing. Sometimes they'll run down there in like 4 hours and have it done, and then the file will be ready by morning. So that is something we definitely take a look at, though, just because we can't get stuck with a piece of land when we think there's a house there.
Yeah, and that makes sense. And it's important to know that also because most lenders are going to require at least some sort of physical visit. So if a buyer is bringing me the deal, I'm probably going to want to know, like, hey, did you have your guy go through when we did our showing? Because sometimes wholesalers have a royal pain in the ass time getting access to show a property. And sometimes there's, you know, one, two showings. And so the other thing that would preclude me from wanting to get in bed with a hard money offer is typically there's going to be an appraisal they're going to have to get through. And then maybe there's a secondary walkthrough with someone like yourself. And so now I'm looking at two different visits just to find out if we have a live deal that's going to close or not. And so it's easier to take, you know, the cash investor. So like one tip I might have for somebody that saw a red hot deal, understand that. Most wholesalers, while, yes, yeah, some deals will have plenty of access and it's a shell and you can just let yourself in, different story. But a lot of the wholesalers have, you know, the person who's selling the house is living there and the wholesaler is in an uncomfortable position to show the property 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 times. And that's why they're like having one single showing. And so if you're really serious about a deal, you get the email from a wholesaler, you review the photos, and you're kind of like inclined to almost send a contract sight unseen and lock it up. That's like how good and reasonably priced the deal is. It might be worth it to engage your hard money person ahead of time somehow, maybe even pay that person to attend an inspection with you so that when you're submitting the offer and, you know, Ian's hopping on the phone, just, hey, I already had the, you know, my guy already came through. He was there with me. I brought my lender to that showing. Like, here's my offer and this is what I can do. That's going to give you a leg up in my book. That's going to be like, wow, okay, this guy like is serious and, you know, his offer is now competitive. I don't know how realistic that is, and I wouldn't expect you to kind of like answer that question on the horn right now, but I know that would probably help from my perspective. I think to sum up so far what we talked about, Ian, I would say, okay, so, you know, one of the first steps here, if you're wanting your hard money financed offer accepted, is going to be selecting the right hard money lender. Ian, do you guys, if it were required, would you guys show a bank statement to get a offer accepted if it were like a competitive, you know, situation for your buyer?
Would I say it one more time? Would I be offering what?
Would you show a bank statement or some other proof of funds to somebody, or would it just be the letter and that would be the extent?
I mean, it's usually all I need. I think one time in my entire, all the deals I've done, I've actually, you know, had to show a quote unquote bank statement because I just get on the phone with the person and, you know, I can certainly do it. I wanted to go back to something you had just mentioned though about the showings, and I respect that as a wholesaling, from a wholesaling perspective. So I'm aware of that, you know, it is a pain in the butt to go ahead and have to schedule inspection after inspection. We actually can do, and I don't really advocate this, and you really have to know your own risk threshold as a private lender, but, you know, I've done plenty of just drive-by inspections. Like, we can't get in the house, you know, and the wholesaler's trying to close this deal, or I'm doing a sheriff sale deal where you can't get access to the house. I have to be really comfortable with the pictures from the exterior, but that's also something you want to ask the lender in your that you're dealing with. You know, hey, I cannot get you in. Is it possible to do this with a drive-by. And if they can make that decision on it, maybe they might say no. They might say, I don't want to do it. I don't trust this house, or, you know, whatever. But if they have the ability to at least do that, it's really important. And as far as the bank statement goes, sure, if needed, yeah, we can easily show enough money to cover. But usually just an approval letter is what most people need.
And so that brings me up to my next question. When I have that offer on the table, first of all, I'm not going to accept, in all honesty, a significantly lower hard money financed offer than the guy offering cash. So assuming the offer's the one I'd like to accept based on like the price and maybe a solid earnest money deposit, like I might take $1,000 or $2,000 deposit from somebody who shows a bank statement with enough cash and says, hey, I'm closing in cash. Whereas if I had one, you know, marginally better than that offer from a hard money, hard money financed offer. And it was, let's just say I haven't done business with that person before, because that would be a totally different story if I knew they were capable of closing and they had that reputation. But one thing that would sway me to go with that hard money offer that might not be much better than the guy who's offering cash would be a larger earnest money deposit. So if this buyer is confident enough in his relationship with that hard money lender where he says, you know what, I'll put a $5,000 earnest money deposit down, or even a $10,000 earnest money deposit down. I don't need any due diligence or other clauses for inspection contingencies or appraisal contingencies or anything like that. I know my numbers. I know my hard money lender, and I'm willing to put my earnest money deposit at risk. I'm gonna roll with that guy. If he's willing to put that on the table without, you know, some sort of wiggle out clause in the contract, there's a great chance I'm gonna go with that guy. So my first question, you know, assuming the earnest money is decent and there's not inspection period clauses attached to that offer, my next question is gonna be, hey, have you closed with that lender before? And I'm assuming, Ian, As a hard money lender who's basing his risk analysis off of market data and knowing neighborhoods, that drive-by appraisal and like a Google Drive photos link from your buyer, right, from your borrower, that's probably going to fly with you if it's someone who's done 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 deals with you, as opposed to like someone who's coming to you the first time and trying to get you to fund a deal based on a drive-by. Am I guessing correct right there?
Yeah, there's definitely a relationship factor with the hard money lender. If you've got an ongoing relationship, there's definitely a sense of ease. The first deal is always the toughest in terms of, because you're dancing, you're doing the dance to see how much does the lender trust you, how much will the lender show up for you. Like, so you're both dancing. Honestly, you know, if I'm going to say you're going to take your best stab at your first deal with a new lender, make sure that you've got accurate numbers, don't undershoot your construction, and, you know, don't argue with the values that the lender's comfortable with. Like, you either hit the numbers or you don't. But if you have a repeat buyer, yeah, that's a great question. If you're wholesaling a property, how many properties has this lender funded for you? Because then they've already got an ongoing relationship that's strong, and when they say they're going to show up. So that's a really great question from a wholesaler's perspective, for sure, for a lender.
And I'll share, like, there's a few things we have closed, right? So like before, Ian, I didn't even consider anyone's hard money. I didn't want to hear it. This is about, you know, 2 years ago, give or take, maybe. There were nowhere near the number of lenders in the marketplace that there are now. I'm probably 2016 or so. Different story now. But a couple of the things that buyers have done to increase their positioning power with me and my organization is two things. They said, yeah, we've closed with the lender before. You know, we did XYZ number of deals. I think it was like 5. This was what actually one of the institutional lenders. It was, it was one of the jump through hoops, you know, appraisal institutional lenders. And we've done a couple deals like that. But there were two things that were included that really helped us sway us, to ride with that buyer and take our property off the market. The first of which was the buyer provided an Excel spreadsheet with, you know, their deal resume was right there on the spreadsheet, and they had numbers listed out. Construction was this amount. Our hard money payments were that amount. Our purchase price and closing costs was this amount. Our sale price was this amount, and our net profit was this amount. And so they put a lot of information there that when we saw that, I mean, and they said who the lender was on each of those deals. And it was a different tab on a spreadsheet that they compiled. And this spreadsheet, I'm sure, based on the number of deals that were on this spreadsheet, and they submitted this without us asking, that spreadsheet has surely won them more deals than just the deal that we had closed with that buyer as a result of them literally preparing this like presentation where we couldn't argue. I mean, they had the track record with the lender, that didn't appear to have any issues, and we ended up closing that deal without any issues on ours either. I think it was the same buyer who provided bank statements to us, which didn't show the full cash amount for the property. I think it was like a $65,000 property they were buying. They were going to renovate it, so it was another 60, 70 grand. They needed like $130,000 for that property, but the proof of funds they submitted, I think, had somewhere in the range of $40,000, maybe $50,000 on there. But what that proved to me, as the person holding the decision in my hand whether or not to get in bed with this buyer and take my property off the market, was not only did they close with this lender before, but this person has enough money to put down on, down payment and cover the interest payments. And so I was able to look into, this investor's finances at kind of the same level that another hard money lender, whether it was institutional or traditional or not. But like, I know I'm seeing the same information. This guy is like, he's bankable. Like, he didn't have to show me his tax returns, his credit, and all of that, but it put me at ease because a lot of the hard money offers that I get come across my desk, Ian. We've even gotten in bed with a few of them. Suddenly they have, $1,000, $2,000 in the bank. They can't even cover one interest payment on this loan. No lender in their right mind was going to lend them the money on this one. I mean, does that make sense?
Sure. No, it's actually, that type of buttoned up buyer is, and too, it's rare. To get a guy at that level. But like that, if you're trying to present yourself as a borrower, whether you've done one deal or 10 deals, like having all of that presented, and whoever's listening to this got a good look at what would make your lender feel better about you, what would make your wholesaler feel better about you. Like, that's a polished, well-structured buyer that has all the answers because they know all the questions that are going to be asked. So yeah, it's fantastic to have and I certainly have clients like that, and I certainly have clients that are not like that. But those are the ones that really, when you have to make a decision, like you said, like if you're going to be between two offers or you're going to be, hey, should we do this deal or not? A buyer like that or a borrower like that is going to be put you in a position where you're going to feel much more comfortable, doing that deal with them and saying, okay, I'm going to do it, as opposed to maybe your gut instinct is, no, I don't want this to happen because, they couldn't even respond to an email in like 4 days or whatever it may be. A guy like that is responsive, detailed, has everything in line. And that, I guarantee you, you're not the first time that guy has gotten deals because of his activity level of being in that capacity. And I certainly have guys like that I'm sure they get a lot of their deals just because that's how they present themselves.
Yeah. And I go to get traditional financing to cover the rentals and, my own house and things of that nature. And I have an unusual business in real estate. Being in Atlanta, Tampa, Miami, Chicago, Philadelphia, and we have all these different partners and all these different holding companies. And so when I provide my tax returns, I mean, there's numbers on there. But what I do additionally, because most of the time when I'm going to get refinance loans and I want decent interest rates, usually my information is going on the desk of some decision makers, an underwriter. Sometimes they have a loan committee at these banks. So I actually write a letter based on wherever we are. The letter changes and it updates over time, explaining, a little bit about the business model, a little bit about, what we have going on and some reasons why I might not be such or why I'm not a bad risk or why I am a good loan risk, whether or not that had any impact above and beyond my credit score, my finances and my reserves is kind of unknown. But I've heard that tip from other people who've been on the show, other people in the marketplace, and that presentation power, that package, that it's not easy. You got to take the time and put together all the details. And over time, your package gets, more and more powerful, more and more presentable. But yeah, not only to the desk of the lender, but to the desk of the person who you're trying to submit the offer. It kind of reminds me of when I'm selling deals retail and we've done a nice job. We're in 2019. This has been, highest and best multiple offer situation like 3 or 4 years now in the real estate market, whether you're buying cash at the investor level or whether you're a retail buyer, because of the lack of inventory in the real estate market and a lot of the other economic conditions that we've had so far. But we get retail buyers who send us pictures of the ultrasound. They send us pictures of you know, their wedding. Their wedding pictures are there, and they've got this nice letter put together. If they weren't the highest offer, which they were in every instance, and there were multiple offer situations, we wouldn't have been swayed to take a lower offer with that appeal. But surely that person had learned the hard way by missing out on one or two deals. And all of a sudden, I mean, they're just, you know, trying to put that presentation power to effect. So, hey, it works. It works in both avenues.
It can't hurt you, right? Like, worst case scenario, you spend a little bit extra time. Like, there's no reason not to do it, other than just being lazy, I guess. I don't really know, or just not having your act together. But, you know, when you're doing something like that, depending on how bad you want something, and depending on how you want to be, you know, I think also that presentation power is more, you know, what I'm thinking about when I receive, like, you know, somebody's package like that, or it's well put together. It's more like we're speaking the same language. We're at the same table. Whereas if it's just somebody that just can't get their act together and it's just loose and everything's a mess, we're not at the same table. Like, and if you want to pull up a chair, you know, speak the language that I speak. So that's really, and if you're not going to, that means all I'm saying, all you're doing is introducing fear into me. And that fear is my way of saying risk level go down, aggression level on the loan go down. So if you want to make, you want the person at the table with you to be very comfortable. And if they're comfortable with the scenario with you, do your presentation. It's crazy not to put it together if you have the ability to do that.
Yeah. And I guess one other suggestion that pops to mind here would be, you already mentioned it. Does this person respond to emails in 4 days or 4 minutes? I know it's not reasonable to sit by the computer. We're all busy. The whole world is busy and, you know, bounce documents back at lightning speed. But if you're in the middle of a deal like this, or you're in the middle of an offer cycle, whether it's with a seller directly, whether it's with a real estate agent, or whether it's with a wholesaler, or whether it's you're trying to get, you know, the hard money guy to finance your loan and accept the risk, like, the money loves speed. And the faster that you can get turned around your documents, your tax returns, if they were necessary, your, you know, letter, your signed addendums, your earnest money deposit emailed over or dropped off same day, the title company, like, the faster that you can do your business, the better your reputation will be with those people throughout that transaction. But it will also build momentum for you long term. I'm sure you'd agree with me on that, right?
Yeah, I mean, I pride myself on responsiveness for sure. You know, there's another guy in Philadelphia. He was technically probably still, but he's the biggest agent in the entire nation, Mike McCann. I'm sure you know who he is, Dan, but anybody listening very well might know him. And one of his, you know, his number one traits is his responsiveness to emails. And I remember there was a couple articles written on him, and it was just the guy. I mean, it's no joke. I mean, if you email Mike McCann right now, anybody listening to this, if you email Mike McCann, you will get an answer almost instantly from him. So it's 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And that's, we're in a time right now, in my opinion, that you are attached to your phone, you're attached to this. And if you're right in the fact that if you're, there's different priorities on emails, you know, you and I, Dan, we're setting up a podcast. You don't have to respond to me in 30 seconds, right? There's not when you were emailing me 2 weeks ago, but because there's not a sense of urgency. But when you're in the middle of the deal, you're in the middle of a transaction or a potential client, you know, we're in the age of instant. So everything being instant is what the expectation is. And I've always looked at it like, if I don't handle this right now, and I know there's a priority to it, somebody else will pick up that phone, and that 5 or 10 or 15 grand or whatever I'm going to make, or whatever that number is going to be, was that 30 seconds of not picking up or being lazy worth somebody else taking that money from me? And that's, it's at this point, it's just ingrained in my brain and who I am, but I find it very important.
I agree. So one other thing, and I know this is going to be like opening a little bit of a Pandora's box probably for me. This may or may not be appropriate for the situation, and it potentially could piss off a wholesaler or a real estate agent in the end if you don't end up closing the deal. But what what I've done myself on a couple of wholesale deals. I'm buying from a wholesaler. I have access to get money, which is really important to note. So it wasn't like I was just like stepping out there on complete faith that the universe would catch me and fund a deal. But I went to the showing, I made the offer, and I locked it up immediately. Like, I had emailed the guy a check within an hour of echecks.com is email checks from your bank accounts. Really powerful stuff when it comes to paying contractors, or when you're trying to send earnest money deposit checks instantly, so you can put people at ease. Just a quick pro tip there. But I didn't mention anything about going to a lender at all. I have really great relationships with banks, roll out the red carpet kind of treatment where I do business. So I ended up not mentioning or putting in any kind of financing or letting them know there was hard money or anything like that. I didn't even mention that. In fact, I didn't mention that it was going to be cash either, so it was completely transparent what I had said. But I did put a substantial earnest money deposit down, and I did accept the agreement like as is. No due diligence period, no attorney review period, no appraisal contingency, no inspection contingency, and I got my offers accepted. And you could probably get away with that even with me. If you send something with a $10,000 deposit, like, I'm going to assume you're closing. I probably won't even ask for proof of funds with a deposit of 10 grand. Because I know if you walk away, and you know if you walk away, you're losing the 10 grand. So, like, one other caveat to trying to make your offers more appealing could be potentially to not offer up the hard money information at all on the front end, but replace it instead with a large earnest money deposit. So if it's, you know, if it's a $30,000, $40,000 transaction, $5,000 is going to get my attention. If it's a $100,000, $150,000 transaction, $10,000 is going to get my attention. If it was increasingly higher priced than that, you know, the number would probably keep going up. And like I said, I mean, you're kind of playing with fire, because if you don't get the money together and you don't close the deal, you're going to be out your deposit. But you can get that deal accepted if you're the kind of person who already has established relationships with hard money lenders, and you know they're not going to leave you hanging dry at the settlement table when the time comes. Any insight or advice against that, Ian?
No, I actually think it's great advice. I think it's, so I remember back when we used to wholesale quite a bit, we had enough deals fall out, and we had to find a threshold that was like, I don't really care whether this person's cash or not, because I need to just find a number that somebody won't walk away from. And that won't walk away from number is exactly what you just said. For us back in the day, it was $5,000. If they put $5,000 down, they're closing the deal. It's just enough money. It doesn't break them, but they're not walking away from, they're not handing somebody $5,000 and walking away. And if it's a $200,000 deal, yeah, $20,000, $30,000, $40,000. So it's just, it's a great idea. I think every, you know, wholesale, especially in a buyer's market like this, in a market where you guys wholesaling wise have to be killing it right now. I mean, this market is tenfold better than what it was. And I mean, you wholesaled back 10 years ago too, so you know the difference in the two markets. So at this point, you know, when you have a guy that is, you know, saying I'm going to put $500 down on a deal, everybody should be putting $20,000 down, and then it's also the seriousness of it. Because if you can't do that, like, why not? Why, like, the, you know this, all your big buyers, all your real cash buyers, they don't give a damn. They'll put the entire thing in escrow today. They don't care, because they know what they're looking at. They know what they're buying. Somebody that says I'm only going to put $500 down, to me, is there something I'm missing? There's something behind the scenes that is squirrely. What are you not telling me? Like, why only $500? Why would you do that? You know, if you know what you're looking at, you know you're going to buy it. It is as you stated, to put the money down. So I firmly agree with it. I think it's insulting when somebody says I'm going to put, you know, $100 down on your wholesale deal. Now, if you want to put $100 down to hold the contract as the wholesaler, that's fine. That's fine in my opinion, because it's a totally different relationship. But from an investor to an investor, you know, get out of here. Like, you know, if you've got money, you're liquid and you can play, put the money down. You know, it's weird. It's two different worlds, but one is acceptable and one is not, in my opinion.
Yeah, I agree. And one caveat here is there's some little nuances that are different in each particular market. So I'm going to run through them quick here, just so everyone's kind of aware. In Philly, a $5,000 deposit is kind of kind of what it is. It's the run of the mill. Like a lot of, you know, the offers getting accepted coming through wholesalers, it's $5,000. Can you get them accepted with $1,000, $2,000? Probably. It's our policy to get $2,000. A lot of our deals were selling for $25,000, $35,000, $45,000. $2,000's enough, but I'm going to want to see proof of funds. And in Philadelphia, generally, these are hard deposits immediately, meaning if you don't close the deal, you're not getting the money back. That's the only way you're locking up deals, in the investor market. You can prove me wrong, and I'm sure you can get us, you know, sneak in some inspection or do something unusual. But for the most part, the culture is hard deposits immediately to lock the deal up. Now, if we go to Atlanta, which is a hotter market, they've seen more appreciation. Atlanta is going to be the same way. The deposits are generally lower. It's not $5,000 deposit. There's rarely a $5,000 deposit, or maybe on a $200,000 or $300,000 house. And a lot of occasionally someone will break the mold, and I encourage it. If you're going for a deal, you're going to pay $200,000 in cash anyway. Why not just throw $20,000 in escrow and get the deal with the big escrow deposit and prove you're not walking away? And yet the culture is $1,000 and $2,000 deposits. And to make it even, you know, more complicated, which is an uphill battle that we fight successfully. No one gets to sneak in due diligence periods, but Atlanta is the market of due diligence periods. So everyone thinks it's okay to negotiate, get the contract, lock it up for 5 days due diligence, then decide if they want it. And typically when there's due diligence on the contract, Ian, they're backing out of the deal at the end of the due diligence period. I'd say 1 in 8, maybe 1 in 10, where we allow due diligence, right? Because sometimes it's the best offer and we really want that offer to fly. So like 1 in 10 sticks when we're out on the due diligence limb in Atlanta. And if you come to Chicago, same thing. Generally going to be $1,000, $2,000 deposits. If you start getting into some pricier areas, you could get a $5,000 or $10,000 deposit. But we are the land of the attorney review period. And when I first got here, I'm like yelling, I'm screaming, I'm throwing stuff at the wall. We're not signing anything attorney review. What are you talking about? That's just how it's done here. No one will enter a contract without an attorney review. And then the attorneys battle back and forth each other for these stupid little modifications of this clause and that clause. It happens on every deal, and it's pretty rare in Chicago, you know, Illinois market, that someone puts an immediately hard deposit up. So when I come in and I'm buying a $450,000 property, I can put a $5,000 hard deposit on that contract with no attorney review and me paying the closing costs, and that's a super strong, that is an unusual offer, and I'm okay taking that kind of risk because I understand how real estate transactions work and, you know, what's going to be like my negative, or maybe I'm losing the $5,000 and that might be something I'm willing to do on a specific deal. But it's nuts. All the deals are constantly falling apart. I'd say we probably have a 50-50 stick rate in Chicago. So if you're in Chicago, you're in Atlanta, and you want your offer accepted, a little bit of more deposit and take out your due diligence and take out your attorney review clauses. It's really strange how the different parts of the country operate a little bit differently.
Yeah, I had no idea. I definitely learned something from that from you today. So if I ever head up into those markets, very good to know.
Yeah, for sure. So are there any little pieces on our how to win bids from wholesale? And everything we talked about winning from a wholesaler can be applied to a real estate agent, and you will awe and wow the real estate agent with some of these like powerful contract things, because a lot of times they're just not used to getting those kind of agreements put in front of them. But are there any other tips or things that we forgot to mention that you think will be important right now?
I don't think so. I think we kind of hit the inside baseball from the lender's perspective really well, and then the wholesalers. And, you know, we're looking at similar things, I would say, and we're looking for similar things. So if all those are in order, you know, I would say from the lending perspective, if all the, you know you have the right lender based on the speed and the access and the lack of appraisal and so forth. And from the wholesaling perspective, having that package together, I think is really important. And putting a large deposit down is a very sure way to, you know, like you said, we're in a buyer's market, and wholesalers are usually not, you know, scrambling to sell a deal. They're typically looking at 3 or 4 offers, and all 3 or 4 offers have a little bit of something different to them. So to come in with strength, you know, a package, a strong no contingency deposit, those are things you're going to want to do. And you're not really going to know why you might miss a deal either. So somebody might just say, sorry, it's already locked up, but they didn't tell you, hey, it was razor thin, but all you had to do was this guy came in with a package and this guy came in with an escrow. So put your best foot forward in a buyer's market to get the property. You can't hope for a little bit more because you're going to miss deals. So I think you covered it all. And I just think people have to be aggressive with, you know, how well they're put together when they're presenting themselves to lenders and certainly to wholesalers.
Nice. So we do have a little bit of time on the clock here, but with an eye on the clock, I have a question I really want you to touch on because I think it's so valuable for the listeners. And that's, I certainly have a mindset or had a mindset of anti-leverage for a long time. And I just wanted to buy my stuff with cash. I was buying my rentals with cash and nothing was moving as fast as it should. And I still am a very, very conservative investor, both in real estate, stocks, and even with flipping houses. I am conservative. I don't like the debt that I do have to take on. So I take it sparingly and, you know, with an eye toward the future where the economic cycle might be somewhat different than it is today. That said, for investors who, let's say, are kind of flipping houses on their own cash, or they maybe have, you know, grandma or their parents had $100,000-$150,000 that they kind of like invested, but that person is now starting to find more deals than they have the cash for, which is probably chapter two for real estate investors. Chapter one is, oh my God, I need the cash to find, you know, to flip houses. And then you realize you have to get the deal first. And then maybe you had enough cash to do one deal, two deals. And then you get to phase two, chapter two, where you've built the network, you've got your systems, you start to know what deals are. And all of a sudden you're seeing more opportunities than you have money. So let's say that investor has, I don't know, Ian, $100,000-$150,000 in cash, could be his cash, could be a lender's cash, wherever it is. They have this cash, have access to this cash. And they've been buying maybe one or two houses at a time, and then they're running out of money for projects. Do you have clients that kind of like fit that mold and then maybe reach like chapter three or phase three where they were able to leverage up from like two projects at a time to doing like, I don't know, three, four, five? Like maybe you could share a story without naming names of someone who's kind of transitioned through that and you've been a part of that as their hard money lender during that process.
Yeah. So interesting. Yeah. I'm not a huge, funny that I'm in the business of leverage, but I'm not a huge fan of leverage either. So I don't think it's inherently evil. I just think what it is it's very easy. You really got to have discipline and know what you're doing to use it correctly. And then when you do, it's an extremely powerful tool, and still remaining conservative through leverage is important. You know, like what Warren Buffett's saying is the only things that'll knock you out of the game are liquor, ladies, and leverage. So those three things, that's how it works. So, you know, there's a certain element of being completely liquid through a turn cycle, like a cycle turn in the real estate market, that is really important. But a lot of times to accumulate that wealth or that money to get to the point where you're going to be aggressive on a cash position in the next downturn is going to be by using leverage on the way up. So leverage to me comes down to confidence. You know, if you're going to succeed with it or you're going to fail at it, is going to come down to confidence and really, truly knowing how well you know the inside of your business and your market. Because if you don't know it, taking leverage is a really tempting apple on a tree, and you're going to take it and then you're going to overutilize it. Before you know it, you're paying your own bills with the leverage against your equity. And the business isn't running itself anymore. You're taking too much money out of it and it gets out of control. I've seen it. We built our property management company in 2008 and so forth. I remember seeing so many people that took the apple on the tree, and they just over leveraged themselves to the gills, and they instantly could, the market said no more, and they just ripped it out from under everybody. So there is a place for leverage, but it really is a time and place that you have to understand your business. Now, when you're talking about an individual that says it has $100,000 or $125,000 liquid cash, maybe they've been flipping for 10 years and they constantly see they buy it with their own, you know, maybe house for $30,000, put $30,000 in and resell it for $120,000 or something. They've been doing that for 10 years. And every time they put all their money on the street, they see a couple of deals passing by. But in the meantime, they've really learned their market. They've flipped a lot of houses with their own cash already. They just realize there's deals passing them by. And when they know that and they see them and they start going, okay, I know how much money I can make on that one because I've done so many of these without leverage that, you know, I need to tap into doing two or three of these at a time. So then what happens is they come to me and I usually explain to them, I say, your buying power. So if you have $100,000 in the bank account, that's worth $500,000 typically for a hard money lender. Say anywhere from $300,000 to $700,000. $500,000 is a good leverage on that in terms of 5-to-1 buying power. So you can buy, instead of buying one house now, you can buy five or whatever that number may be. So I've had clients specifically that use us. I also see when they get ahead of themselves. So come to us and they'll start with one or two. And then I can tell when they're doing three and four and they have maybe five open loans with us. And I realize what they're doing is they're scaling. They're really trying to scale hard. But you have to understand with scaling a business that it's not just about getting access to capital. It's about the infrastructure inside the business as well. So there's a huge difference between flipping one house and flipping five houses at a time. It is, you're constantly juggling. You have contractors that you're managing. You have scopes of work that have to be handled. So the problems also get amplified by five times. The problems and the issues, so more money, more problems, right? So gets amplified as well. So what I see is I've seen guys succeed at it. I've seen guys fail at it. The ones that fail at it have no ability to manage. They had access to capital. They had no ability to manage the inside of a business. They really weren't a business owner that could scale. They were a one man, one house show. And that was it. It's similar to an operator of like maybe a store or 7-Eleven. It's a mom and pop shop. They can operate one shop. They themselves are there every day and they're handling it. That is the single flipper. Now, that same flipper, if they try to go, they want to open up five or six stores, or do five or six houses, doesn't mean they have the skill set that it takes to manage those projects. There's a totally different skill set in scaling and compartmentalizing and having systems in place. So that is the downfall that I see in when people try to scale. But when you have a very, typically it's actually the person we talked about earlier in this interview, which was like the person doing the presentation, the person that has everything together in their life, they're detail oriented, they're fast, they're understanding that. Those kind of people are the ones that also tend to use leverage correctly. So it just comes hand in hand. So that borrower that was good for maybe buying your wholesale deal or doing my loan is typically a very polished person, whether they don't even know they're capable just yet of doing a scaled business model with like hard money, but they are. The personality traits are there. The way they operate their life is there. And those are the ones that succeed is because they run a tight ship. They just haven't really taken the ship to sea yet by taking $100,000 extra or $500,000 extra. So the first question I would say ask yourself if you really want to scale and use leverage is forget the money. Am I capable of, you know, how do I operate? Am I an organized person? What are my skill sets? Can I run five of these at once? Can I run four of these at once? Do I have the ability to manage cash flow properly? As in, do I do my accounting tight? Do I make budgets correctly? You know, or am I my guy's going to be done next week and he's not done for 3 weeks. He's not done for 5 weeks. I don't have a scope of work. I write it down on a napkin. That is a one-man band. It can be done for a one house, but not for five. So ask yourself, do you have the skill set first? Then at that point, if you know your market, you've been doing it for a while, you have deals passing you by, a hard money loan or somebody in the hard money world is going to be a great tool for you to accelerate your current status in life, because you've already got the skills in place. You just didn't even know it yet. So if you're that person that fits that personality, now you can go from doing, you know, making 30 or, you know, seeing, let's say you're doing three deals a year, making 100 grand, flipping 30 grand a deal. You could easily take that up to 500 grand pretty quickly if you have the skill sets already in place. If you try to do that without having the skill sets in place, even if you find the deals, even if you have access to the capital now, you are going to create a world of hurt for yourself. So those are the differences I see in the kinds of people. It comes down to their personality more than it does their bank account in terms of how they excel at scaling their business.
Yeah, that's a whole lot of great information there, Ian. Do you or have you had the conversation like about that? Has anyone reached out? Like, I've found that some of the other hard money lenders that I know personally are kind of a resource, especially the good ones, right? So you're talking about things like access to capital plus the infrastructure and a whole lot of things that a lot of people don't think of. You know, on their own always. So it's proof that you study and understand business. Have you had the conversation with people who are at that decision point, maybe talked some of them into it, maybe talked some of them out of that? And is that something you do for a potential client if they happen to be in the Philadelphia area and they're listening to this right now?
Absolutely. I usually tell my clients that like my best clients are the ones that utilize me as a resource, not so much as just money. You know, a good hard money lender will provide that because I want to see that person do a lot of deals. That if they're doing deals, they're making money, they're doing more deals. I don't want them to go down the road of implosion just because there's a couple extra deals in front of us. Like that doesn't help anyone. So I have certainly had that conversation with certain people about scaling and not scaling. I'll explain what it is, but certain people say, hey, do you think I should go up? Do you think I should? I'll usually say, maybe start with one more, but you know, this is the road it leads down if you try to go too fast. And I'll be super honest with them and super upfront with, like, maybe I have an example of somebody that I've worked with that's done it or whatever it may be. On the flip side, if I'm like, hey, look, you know, you're one of the most talented flippers in this business. You don't even know it yet. Because you're beyond flipping. You have the mind for infrastructure of a business and the coordination for putting systems in place. And this is just how you operate. You just haven't done this yet. I'll also give them that vote of confidence if I see it. Because it's super repetitive. Like, the type of person that is able to scale properly is a very similar personality type, and the way they organize their lives and everything, it's all very similar. So it's pretty easy for me to spot, and vice versa. When you're going to head yourself down a road of just you've kind of capped out at, you know, one to two deals at a time, stay there unless something big in life changes or you hire somebody that, you know, is highly, highly organized and on point. So I absolutely have those conversations, because good, bad, or indifferent, I'd like to continue doing business with that person at the level of capability that they have. And if they want to get greedy or they want to try something else, you know, they want to be mad at me for not giving them the information they wanted to hear. You know, I don't ever want to say, like, I told you so, because you never want to see somebody lose money. Like, that sucks. But, you know, I don't know. Come talk to me in a few years if you found another outlet to go down that road. And if I'm wrong, I'm wrong. But I never do it in the intent to, like, not do business with somebody. I do it, honestly, to help somebody in their business.
Yeah, I remember when I first got in the business, and I'm sure, like a lot of people, I kind of had that. I don't drink, but I had that, like, the beach with the margaritas and the umbrella thing, like that image of, like, what real estate invest, right?
Sure.
And now we're hundreds of deals per year, me and a team of, I don't know, 35 people plus, give or take. There's people coming and going out of that number on a consistent basis in all these markets. And every one of us works our asses off, and I'm so grateful for us to do that. But it's definitely not the passive sit back, relax, and money's just like pouring in while I'm on the beach. That's not where I am. That's not the reality. The hard work, the hustle, the organization, we work our asses off to get the results. And all the people that I know who are doing, you know, any kind of volume are they're working at the same level.
I don't know anybody in that margarita world. I don't know anybody making it in this business. I don't know. I haven't met him yet. Let me introduce me to him when you meet him. But that margarita beach world, that's for the birds, man. The guys that are making it and killing it are even the most expensive. I know a guy we're very close to with billions of dollars, works every day of his life. Like, the guy's not, he probably takes a trip once or twice a month. But that guy works. So it doesn't exist in my world.
Yeah. I mean, it's the game. I think falling in love with the game and with the hustle and with the work and doing this and creating something, I think is much more important, at least to me, in like finding the success that I sought than it was, like, I don't know, something else that didn't work out for me.
Sure.
Cool. Ian, I think you've been on the show a couple times, and I know we ask some questions of all of our guests here. I want to ask two here as we kind of wrap up at the top of our episode here and be respectful of your time. I know we're getting to the top of the hour here. So one question would be, and you may have answered it before, but I found that sometimes book recommendations change over time as your own business acumen and new information becomes available. So would you mind sharing two book recommendations that, you know, experienced over the last year? Doesn't have to be like a real estate book, but like one or two books that maybe you would recommend to me as an experienced investor.
Gosh, you know what? I'm not a book reader, but the one that I recently had sent to me, which I enjoyed, was Life in Air. Actually, I don't know if you know Dan Topsky. I think you do. He sent that to me. It was a nice gift. Yeah. So that was that's an eye opener. It kind of shifts your perspective on things in life, which I think is applicable to success in business and in life, which was really important. And the other one, and I can't remember it. My other business partner just sent it to me, and I've been audio listening to it, and I can't remember the name of it. So I can give you one book. I can't give you two. And if I remember the second one, I'll email it to you.
Fair enough. I think Dan's been on the show, and I think he might have recommended that. And I did not listen to that one yet, or read it, rather. Mm-hmm. So I'll have to circle back around now that it's showing up twice. But if you could go back, Ian, I don't know, let's just say 5 years ago. So it's 2019 now. If you could go back 5 years and share the crown jewel of wisdom, knowing what you know now, what would that be? What would you tell yourself back in 2012?
What would I have done differently? I would have...
Beside buy more properties, because we know they went up in value,
yeah.
Right?
Sure. I would have said... So I would have said to myself, and I think I did take away from it correctly this time, but I had to go through it, but I'll recognize it the next time. So I learned it was a little more than 5 years ago. 5 years ago, we were still in a high swinging market that was just, we're still there right now. But right before that, when I got to learn what the bottom of a market really looked like, I've ingrained that in my brain in terms of, so it wasn't just 2008, where that's the bottom of the market. That's not really the bottom. We were still searching when the market was crashing to where the bottom was. Like, you remember back then, it was like, all right, it can't go any lower, or the houses can't go any lower. You don't really know. Nobody knows. But then I remember there was a time, and I reiterated this from like a wholesaling perspective, there was a time when we were going into houses, and for probably like a year after the crash, or even 2 years, I forget what it was, the actual bottom was, where people, you would go into their house and they still thought they could sell their, the average person still thought they could sell their house for 2007 numbers, right? They were like, oh no, this is worth this much. And you're like, look, the whole world just ended and you're not recognizing this. And I remember beating our head off a wall, trying to wholesale, being like, it was impossible to find a deal because everybody was delusional in the real world about what their house was worth. And then what happened was, it was over maybe like a 6 month period where all of a sudden, all of the homeowners in a similar time came to the same conclusion and realization that all the equity had been stripped out of their home by the marketplace. The comps were in, the numbers were real. You're only getting 30 grand for this house, because that is really what it was. It was this weird, uncoordinated, like hive mind moment in the marketplace that everybody says, okay, my equity is gone. I have accepted this. I'm no longer in the denial phase. I have to move on with my life. When that happened over that 6 month period, it was something that we recognized that we lived through. And that, when you look back and corresponded to the actual bottom of the market, was right when that happened. There was about a 6 month time, maybe a year and a half in, or 2 years, I forget what it was, after 2008, where I could just sense that the maximum pain threshold had been found. And the maximum pain threshold is where you find the bottom of a market every time. And then the other side, the flip side of it, is the maximum euphoria that you'll find the top of a market when everybody's blind and everybody around you that shouldn't be making money is making money. They just trip over money. So you get either or. And that was something was my takeaway. And I will remember that coming into this current cycle. When that happens again, then I'll know we are at the bottom.
Nice. So where is the extra supply, the excess supply that we had in 2008 from new construction, and also from the horrible underwriting of the foreclosure boom? Where is the supply coming from this time? Do you think it's single family houses, or do you think that it's going to show up in another sector of real estate?
I don't even think it's going to be in real estate. My honest gut is we had a double down effect. We had mortgages that came into our industry. So like, being in real estate, our actual, the catalyst in the event was something that was in our industry by chance. That was the case. It was just like two things colliding at the same time. What I think will happen in the next one will have nothing to do with real estate. It won't be triggered by real estate, but real estate will certainly be affected, like whatever it's going to cause. If I had to guess, as you have, and this is complete speculation, but I've kind of always been thinking this, is that like, if you have a new world market, the whole world is instant and interactive. You have new currencies being built. You have, countries that have substantial interest in our country's stock markets, such as like China, like overwhelmingly, amounts of money that they bought of our money over time, it could be any of those countries. A devaluing of currency, I think, is something that is really intriguing, and that is something that could crash a market instantly. That is something that nobody would see coming. You could have another country that's been maybe buying up all your currency over the years, for the last 10 years, that you had no idea that it was all owned by foreign, and they all of a sudden they liquidate it, or they flood the market with it. I could see a currency reduction, and then maybe a currency shift into, I'm not like a Bitcoin, Ethereum guy or whatever, but I could see a totally new currency being the dominant currency in the world. And that will change everything for anybody that owns real estate or anything in this country. So I don't think it's coming out of real estate. I think it's coming from a different sector of the world. And it has to be something joined where the entire world is interacting with one another. It won't be segregated.
Yeah, I'm planning to give a presentation on the economics behind real estate, and I've got the graphs and the charts and everything. I'm going to be doing that at the Ring meeting in Chicago coming up in August. This will have probably already aired by that point in time. But one of the things I noticed was a huge uptick, I think a doubling or quadrupling in bad auto debt currently. So we're starting to see a spike in, you know, in the lending there. Is there anything you're doing to prepare for any of that oncoming, or something that you think you or any clients would do to hedge any of that kind of risk or position yourself better for this time around than 2008?
I mean, I'm not doing anything. I look at it like this. I look at it like this, that I've been in this game. I know my peers. I know my competition. I know the people around me. And if anybody's going to survive, I feel very confident in my own abilities. I can't predict when it's going to happen. So I know that if everybody that's going to feel the pain, I'm going to know how to deal with it better. My confidence level in being able to deal with that is going to be quite high. There's nothing I'm doing inside my business differently right now. Like, I have to go on what is here. I've always been conservative as a person. So, like, I'm as conservative as can be. I would say the things that I am not at this point in the market are aggressive, you know, speculative at all. I'm definitely not speculative, and I never have been, but now is definitely not the time to be a speculative, you know, investor. And so I'm not doing anything in the aggressive fashion. I'm doing more or less what I do. And sometimes, you know, when we had that scare back in December, that was a real threat to the market space. That was a real threat that we experienced. And the fact that it didn't go down, you know, was, I mean, a whole nother topic on that is that everybody seems to have just pretty much put aside that the president made a phone call to the plunge protection team during that time. And all of a sudden, the entire stock market, the entire world climbed back up, meaning there are five individuals on the entire planet that have the power to rise the entire economy in the world, which is a crazy thought to me. Like, to have that kind of power concentrated in five people, right? That's all that happened. Literally, they said, they made a phone call. Five people said, we're going to absorb the entire world's market, which is crazy. But so, you know, as far as what I do now, I don't do anything different. I just make sure that I am not doing anything speculative. I am and if maybe there are times when we have those times in December like that. Yeah, I was all of a sudden going, this could be very real. So I'm still going to do deals, but you're going to bring more cash to the table, or I'm going to pass on a deal, or whatever it may be. I'll be even more conservative than I normally am.
Nice. Well, that was a great back and forth question to our final question there. Ian, sure. A lot of great content here, a lot of wonderful episode. I really appreciate you blocking out the distractions and taking the time to be on the show. I appreciate it, Ian.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Dan. I really appreciate you having me back on.
And thank you for tuning in to this episode of the REI Diamond Show. On the next episode, returning REI Diamond's show guest, Lane Kawaoka, and I discuss his scaling up of an additional 1,400 units in multifamily, now bringing his total to more than 2,600 units, and some of the critical lessons learned along the way. Also discussed on that episode is bonus depreciation, which is a gift from the new tax code last year for high-income individuals who are interested in passive losses, huge passive losses, coupled with strong investment returns. You will want to keep an ear out for that one. Now, are you interested in the pre-release of the next episode before the email goes out? When you subscribe on YouTube or one of the podcasting apps, including iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher, you'll receive an advance notification as soon as episodes are published, as opposed to Saturday when the email is sent. If you prefer the email, just head on over to reidiamonds.com and sign up. Attention deal makers, I am buying. I buy houses and apartment complex deals in Atlanta, Chicago, Philadelphia, and Tampa. If you have a deal, please contact me directly using the form at reidiamonds.com. Are you an accredited investor interested in short-term passive mortgage investment opportunities with double-digit returns? Head over to fundrehabdeals.com to check out available high-yield investment opportunities. That concludes this episode. Thank you again for tuning in to the REI Diamond Show. Dan Breslin here. Catch you on the next one.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin. To receive email notifications of new weekly episodes, sign up at www.reidiamonds.com.